Thanks for listening to Action Phase Podcast. I'm your host, Tegan Keating. This week, I talk with Dr. Pamela Weibel. She is the creator of the idea of ideal medical care, which is empowering communities to create clinics that actually serve their needs. So she runs these town meetings with patients and helps them talk to their doctors about what they actually want, and then helps the doctors implement what the community actually needs. Dr. Weibel also cares really deeply about doctors' health, and for her, she really believes that happy doctors lead to happy patients. So we spent a lot of time talking about the stress that doctors go through and how med school can give a doctor basically PTSD. And we talk a lot about how doctors can help themselves heal so that they can actually be the doctors that they want to be and help their patients become healthier people. So here we go, Dr. Pamela Weibel. Hi, I'm here with Dr. Pamela Weibel, the pioneer of ideal medical care. How are you, Dr. Weibel? Sorry, Pamela.
Yeah, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So will you just tell us a little bit about what ideal medical care is, how you came up with the idea, all that good stuff?
Yeah, well, I think like most physicians, I wasn't totally happy with my job. Mm-hmm. I had actually tried 6 different jobs in 10 years, you know, everything from community health centers to, you know, physician-owned practices, working part-time, full-time, hospital-owned clinics, and like a multi-specialty group, and locum tenens, kind of everything, every variation I could think of, and I really couldn't take any of these jobs more than a year or two because I felt like I was being treated like a factory worker, like I was supposed to just treat patients like widgets and shoot them down and, you know, a conveyor belt, and I really never got into medicine to be practicing, you know, on an assembly line. So I had thought for a while that I would just go back to waitressing, which is what I did during college because I had a lot of fun waitressing. I got to hang out with the, you know, customers. They were leaving me big tips. Everyone was happy. You know, I did a good job. I think I'm kind of good at human services, but under the constraints of many of these clinics with their high overhead, which is what pushes the high production, it was impossible to be the kind of doctor that I wanted to be. So I kind of had an epiphany one day as I was thinking of applying for a job as a barista at the local coffee shop. I thought, well, you know, I'm not happy. Other doctors aren't happy, and the patients don't really seem happy either with this production-driven medicine. So how about if I lead a town hall meeting and put the patients in charge of designing their own ideal clinic, and then I can actually work for them? And it was super cool. Like, I did that and got 100 pages of written testimony, adopted 90% of their feedback, and we were open 1 month later. And so, you know, what is ideal medical care? It's what the end user considers ideal. You know, what would be ideal for the patient? Of course, practicing good medicine, too. But, yeah, it's really fun now.
So that was in Eugene, Oregon, right?
Yeah, in Eugene, Oregon. Yeah.
So what did that clinic look like, and is it still running?
Yeah, so we've been up since 2005 for like 8 years, and it looks like a homey little living room setting, you know, with a futon and beanbags and, you know, just really comfortable, like, you know, like your own living room at home, kind of cozy, not too big, because people really like small-scale human spaces versus, you know, I don't know if you've seen any big clinics lately, but they're kind of mass production units with big cafeterias style waiting rooms, and that's really not what people want. They want to feel like they're not a number, you know, so it is a humanized environment, you know, where we have longer visits, 30 to 60 minutes, and if they need an exam, we go in the exam room, which is, you know, not set up with lots of scary stainless steel instruments and gauze. I mean, I do have that stuff in there because I do surgery as well, but it's like, it's it's not sitting out in front of their face to scare people. And it's just like a Caribbean theme with, you know, nice shades of turquoise. And it's super relaxing. So people get this actually a healing environment, I would say. And so I think that's the biggest thing that's different. I do everything that any other clinic does, except that I'm moving at a slower, humane pace so people get the care they need, and I'm in an environment that is nurturing and cozy versus scary and cold.
So I have to tell you, I was looking at how where all these ideal medical care practices are now, and I found out that my doctor is one of the ideal medical care practices.
I hope you're enjoying seeing her.
I absolutely love it. I tell everybody to go. It is an experience with a doctor that I have never had before. I never wait more than 10 minutes. I get to see her for half an hour. If I have any kinds of issues, I just send her an email. It's great. So I can personally say thank you for starting this, because it definitely means a lot as a patient.
Well, yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been a labor of love from the beginning for me. And I don't take credit for starting the whole thing. I mean, I was the first one who probably did the town hall meeting part and put the patients in charge of it. A lot of doctors don't necessarily use that the same, you know, town hall to start their clinics, but they do have the notion of just getting back to relationship-driven healthcare instead of production-driven healthcare. I would say those are the two paths. You know, you're either doing production-driven medicine, and it's pretty clear when you're doing that, because as a physician, you're constantly worried about, have I seen enough patients today? Am I moving fast enough? And then the patients feel, oh, I'm just a number. I didn't get all my questions answered. I got rushed out. So that's production-driven medicine, and obviously relationship-driven medicine is what you're experiencing and what I'm getting to give to people, which is my time, energy, love, care, all of that.
And how do you deal with insurance then?
Excuse me?
How do you address insurance if you're working at a slower pace? You know,
I still take insurance. I take like 80% of, you know, most insurance plans that my patients have, and I submit the claims to a free online clearinghouse and then get paid in like 2 to 3 weeks. So I, you know, people can still use their insurance with me, and it works just fine.
That's great. So will you tell me a little bit more about the town hall meetings and what you do and how you interact with people to figure out what it is that they want?
So the town hall meetings, the biggest one that I ever did was 300 people, and that was when I was hired by a hospital system to help them create like an ideal hospital out in Wisconsin. But the smallest town hall I did was 4 people in a living room. So I call it a town hall just because I feel like it is very political in nature, meaning I don't know if you're familiar with the term disintermediation. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
That is really important. I highly recommend that people know what disintermediation is. I'll just spell it. DISINTERMEDIATION. So disintermediation means removing the middlemen.
Oh, okay.
Super important, because as you can see, the way the world is going with the internet and our ability to communicate directly with one another, people really value that. I think the whole idea of having to go through a bunch of hoop jumping and asking permission of middlemen before you do something, it's old. It's stale. People don't want that. They want a direct relationship, like even authors with their readers, you know, through the internet and such, can have direct relationships and chat rooms and, you know, emails and all that. And so there's no more need to have these middlemen who are essentially taking a big cut of the pie financially and slowing things down so that we can't accomplish what we want. So what I did when I decided to lead a town hall meeting is I disintermediated out the pie. politicians. You know, because you can wait forever for politicians to come to your town, you know, an elected official, and meet at town hall and maybe ask people, well, what do you want for health care if they even make it to your town? I mean, I'm in Eugene, Oregon. It's kind of a smaller town. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not that important nationally, like, you know, a big urban East Coast city.
Right.
And so it's not like we necessarily would get, you know, the president or some important person coming here asking people what they want. And, you know, if we did, then what would happen? They'd have to go back to Washington, D.C. with our ideas and then battle it out on our behalf, when, honestly, for primary care, which is super easy to deliver, why am I waiting for a politician to come help me design what essentially is so simple? When I could go directly to the people, ask them what they want. I have a medical diploma. I love my town. I'm not going anywhere, you know. So I ask them what they want. I deliver it. And I don't even have to run for political office. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, that is great. And I think that, because one of the things that is concerning, I think, to everybody who follows anything about healthcare is the lack of primary care doctors that are coming out of medical school. Do you have any sense that there are medical students who are interested in this type of care? And do you work with any of them to help them develop clinics that make sense for their communities? Or, you know, have you had a lot of interaction with them yet?
Yeah, I have medical students who shadow in my office all the time. The whole reason I wrote my book, I don't know if you've seen any of it, mm-hmm. Petco's and Pap Smear's book, is because I had medical students who were shadowing with me, telling me I was the first happy doctor they've ever met.
No.
And it just was like, oh, stab me in the heart. That's so sad. You're kidding. And then they were telling me, like, they were told in medical school that, you know, solo doctors don't exist anymore. So here they are shadowing me, you know, realizing the myths that are being taught, you know, are myths, and that they could actually be the doctor they wrote on their personal statement. See, here's the thing that's so interesting. I think that a lot of people are driven towards primary care, a lot of medical students, you know, when they fill out their applications and write their personal statements, they might be interested in primary care. But then what happens is they get exposed to all these cynical, jaded doctors who are training them, you know? And so if you get trained by, you know, cynical doctors who talk you out of your dreams, it's horrible. So people end up not going to primary care. And of course, tertiary care centers are known for promoting tertiary care, and most medical education happens in tertiary care centers. So it's not like primary care was really, you know, promoted anyway.
Right.
Even years ago, just beyond lip service, you know, I think there's a message that, you know, oh, if you're not good enough to be a surgeon, let's go into primary care or something like that. But honestly, you know, when I talk to these medical students, I ask them how they're doing, even like a few months into their first year, they tell me, you know, they're basically in survival mode, just nose to the grindstone, and they're just trying to make it, right? And I explain, you know, I ask them, how much are you paying for tuition? And they tell me like $50,000 a year. And I have to remind them, you're paying $200,000 tuition over 4 years to learn a skill set that will allow you to be the physician that you described in your personal statement, for which you were accepted into medical school in the first place, right? Because they forget, and they get talked out of their personal statement, which is tragic, which is totally linked to the, you know, the depression and the potential physician suicide that comes later if you get talked out of what you really want to do as impractical.
Right.
But that's really not the case. Anyway, so I'm constantly, you know, encouraging medical students to look for doctors that are happy. If you want to go into a field, please be trained by people who love what they're doing. don't ask jaded and cynical doctors for advice about your future.
Right, because they're burnt out, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah, they're burnt out. They're not that helpful. They obviously haven't figured out how to make medicine work for them, so don't ask them their advice.
Right, and I think that if more medical students had an idea that there was primary care out there that did allow them to be the doctors who they really in their hearts want to be,
uh-huh.
more people would, because what I've been told is that it's often a financial decision because there's so much debt that comes with medical school, and it's harder to make money in primary care. This is what they tell me. I don't know for sure. I don't know the economics of medicine. But that pushes them into specialties that aren't necessarily fulfilling what they wanted to get out of being a doctor. So I wonder if there is a way to change the conversation about medical education and where you go after medical school by talking more about patient-centered care or community-based, you know, community-involved care.
Yeah, I mean, by exposing students to doctors who are happily practicing primary care, that would be really a good first step to include these sorts of doctors who are having successful community practices in medical education training, whether they come in as a guest speaker or whatever. That would be great. I think that, you know, obviously medicine is an apprenticeship profession, so we learn by example, which is, I think, how most humans do things anyway. You learn by example, you watch your parents, and then think, oh, maybe this is how I should parent or not parent. You look at other people, and you see what they're doing, and you see who's happy, and so I think that we need to have more exposure of all the different practice styles and models that are available. Because people end up having a very narrow view of what they could be doing in the future otherwise.
Right, and that leads to burnout, right? If you find yourself in a position that you don't want to be in and you're doing a job that you hate and you're exhausted, you burn out.
And it totally sucks the joy out of you and your pilot light goes right out.
Yeah.
And you wonder, like, why you're not having fun at work, why you're arguing with your spouse, why, you know, it's just, it trickles down into your personal life, and you are not a happy camper.
And you can't possibly have happy patients if you're not a happy doctor.
Yeah, right. We're role models, so people come to us for health and healing. So obviously we need to take our own health really seriously.
So
including
you,
mental health and
right.
our spiritual health. Yeah.
Which you also run retreats for doctors,
mm-hmm.
right? So what happens during those retreats?
At the retreats, there is, it's very beautiful because we have doctors coming from all over the country. And so one of the things that happens there is that doctors finally get to hang out with like-minded physicians in a nurturing environment, you know, off the grid, no cell phone access for 3 days. It's really very healing. It's a beautiful place. It's like 150 acres with all these hot springs, geothermally heated cabins. I mean, it's an absolutely gorgeous place. It's really inexpensive, you know, the retreat center itself. And then it's just beautiful because you see physicians healing from the trauma of their training. You know, if you think about it, I think really it seems to me that most medical students graduate with some type of PTSD.
Oh, God.
You know, we've seen so much pain.
Right.
And death and disease, and we've had to tell people's families that their children just died in a car accident, and, you know, and then we don't have time to process any of this. You know, we basically deliver the bad news, help people die, diagnose people with horrible diseases, and then we have to move on to the next room right away. And so, and confidentiality, by the way, really, really kills physician spirit, because how can you possibly hold on to 30 horror stories every day, day after day after day, decade after decade, and not let it out because of confidentiality? You're not supposed to discuss anything, so you're just supposed to ingest all that pain, and where does it go? You know what I mean? We have empathy for our patients.
Right. I mean,
at least at the beginning.
Most,
and so what are we supposed to do with all that pain and suffering that we witness? We never even have I think in medical schools it should be mandatory weekly balance groups or therapy or something where you get to talk about what you've seen so that you can process it, so you're not walking around with the grief of telling a mother that her newborn died, you know, for the rest of your life.
Yeah, so what...
So that's what happens at the retreat. Some of these doctors who are, like, in their 50s have been carrying around trauma from their early, you know, first and second year of medical school where they've witnessed newborns dying and they never got to talk about it and they're still thinking about it 30 years later.
So what can doctors do then? Because that's not what medical school is doing at all. So, I mean, what... what can they do for themselves?
Well, I would do something to process this, whether it's, some ritual, burning sage, writing in a journal, something, because you cannot just think that you're a robot. I mean, that's part of the flaw of mechanistic reductionist medicine. You know, they train us, I think, still as if we're machines, you know, so that we can be efficient and see so many patients over such a short period of time, not realizing that, like, we have an emotional impact from what we're seeing that's cumulative in our bodies. We're holding on to the pain of things that we've seen if we don't let it go. I mean, you can do stuff like, you know, trying to take a shower after work to kind of rinse it all off, but really, a lot of it you need to process. It's pretty intense, you know? It's not like just forgetting, you know, something, you know, from it. I mean, we're in life and death situations, and how do you, what if you're attached to, what if you're doing pediatrics and you're attached to a child and the child dies, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
and what if part of it had to do with, you know, maybe it was even your fault because you were moving so fast, you didn't have time to check the labs. I have people calling me, pediatric residents calling me, telling them that they feel like they were part of causing some of these deaths because of the speed they have to move. I mean, how do you ever get over that?
Well,
you have to talk about it. It's going to take more than a shower, but anyway.
And if you think about the trauma that, let's say, a parent losing a child would go through and how long it would take to heal and how much work they would have to do to even start to feel whole again. And then you have doctors who have to deal with that multiple times a day, every day. And we don't think about the trauma that doctors do go through, because I think, in part, we like to think of doctors as better than us.
Uh-huh.
You know, non-doctors want to look to doctors and say, well, you know, this person knows everything. They have this aura of superiority. And so they can handle that kind of stuff. And regular people can't.
We're regular people, and we really can't handle the stuff that we're seeing because we're having negative health effects as a result, you know?
Yeah.
Think of all the doctors that you saw before your current doctor. I mean, some of them, you look in their eyes, I mean, they don't even look like they're home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Eyes glazed over.
Yeah.
There are a lot of doctors, they don't look like they're in their bodies anymore. They're just a shell of a human being, and their spirit is gone. Why did that happen? You know?
Yeah, and I mean, we talk a lot about trauma-informed care. It's kind of like a hot topic right now. But we don't, what I've found in reading and talking to people about it and, you know, hearing from all these experts is that sometimes we forget that the people who are doing trauma-informed care are also victims of trauma themselves. And if we
how can you not be? I mean, you're dealing with trauma, frontline, you know, first person, you know, the person who's there as the person dies, or, you know, trying to save people's lives. You're right there. It's, you know, you've got all the burden of being the responsible one.
Right, and being the person that the family expects to be solid. For. You know, you don't expect your surgeon to come out of surgery and tell you that your loved one died on the table and they're also crying. You know, that's not what you expect, and I think a lot of people wouldn't want that. Which, you know, is debatable whether or not, you know, that would be a more acceptable way for people to show their emotions. So
at the retreat, to answer your question, there's a lot of healing, or doctors are healing from 20, 30 years of trauma. And then I have a lot of pre-meds and med students that come, so it's really great for them to see the end result of not dealing with this. You know, they learn from the mistakes of the older doctors, right? It's really beautiful. It's like there's physicians there in all stages of development, from pre-med to near retirement, and they're all hanging out together in a very loving and nurturing way, which, by the way, I never experienced in medical school or in any medical atmosphere. It was always more cutthroat and competitive. I never really experienced sitting among a group of physicians who are really loving and nurturing of one another. That in and of itself is a mind-blowing transformative experience, and then for people to be able to let go of all their trauma, and then basically I teach them all sorts of practice management skills that they need to open their own clinics, so they leave feeling like totally rejuvenated, and their pilot light, which by the time they get there, you know, when they arrive, has been off for years, they leave with their passion and their, you know, I used to use the metaphor of a pilot light, because that's what it feels like, that mm-hmm. the idea of their pilot light got lit again, so they can go out into the world and be the doctor and healer they always wanted to be.
So what is that?
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, I mean, that should just be integrated into med school and every AMA chapter, and it should be just standard practice that there is some sort of self-care involved in being a doctor. I mean...
Yeah, well, what I'm noticing now that they're doing is they have these little wellness classes or mindfulness meditation or things like that, which is fine. You know, that helps you with dealing with stress, or at least talking about, you know, am I feeling well, or what can I do to change my day so that I'm, you know, healthier and exercising and getting sleep and all that. But those are really... kind of running around the periphery. I'm getting at these retreats, it's all about what is your ideal, who are you? And so it doesn't matter how many times you meditate if you're in the wrong career. You know what I mean? You can't meditate your way out of complete misery because you're a radiologist and you really wanted to be in family medicine.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I'm really talking about, like, let's get back to who you are. Who are you? What kind of doctor did you want to be? What is your ideal, and why are you not living it? Because there's no way that you're going to be happy until you honor who you are.
Yeah, and then these doctors who are able to set up practices that mesh with who they are and the doctor they want to be, what does that then mean for their patients?
Oh, their patients are just, like, overjoyed. It's really great. It's just everything is so smooth and easy because people are having fun. You're doing what you were born to do.
And do you think that the focus then becomes more on prevention of disease?
Yeah, if you're spending 30 to 60 minutes with a patient instead of 10 minutes, you definitely have more time to talk about prevention. And, you know, like, sometimes, you know, when I ride my bike to work, people see, oh, wow, my doctor's riding her bike, you know, I'm going to exercise too. Like, you set an example.
Yeah, because, I mean, we know that prevention is the best way for us to help reduce our healthcare spending overall. And so if we have more doctors who are taking the time, they're taking 30 minutes per patient, and they're able to really get into the depths of the problem and, you know, whatever it is that the patient came in for may not be really what the doctor should be addressing in terms of prevention. You know, I'm thinking...
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating why people even go to the doctor. I mean, if you can sit with them long enough to figure out why they're really there beyond what they're saying, it's often completely different.
Yeah.
And what you can accomplish during a visit is totally different if you can actually connect with the whole person outside of just dealing with them as a you know, a machine. You know, I think that people are still trained, tell me if I'm wrong, but people are still trained in reductionist medicine to think of patients as machines that we need to fix, and just looking, you know, just being obsessed with labs and objective data versus, you know, what's their emotional health. Maybe their physical problems are coming from spiritual dis-ease mm-hmm. or emotional dis-ease.
Which I wanted to ask you, on your website, you have a list of the prescriptions that you've written.
Uh-huh.
And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah, that's a chapter in my book. I think it was chapter 13, my favorite prescriptions. Yeah, I look at people, and while they're telling me why they think they're at my office, I'm really scanning them for more details. Like, what, for example, this man who came in, he has a little bit of anxiety, he has a little bit of high blood pressure, and he was telling me that he was ready. He's an older man, disabled, sweet, sweet soul. He felt like he was ready to have a relationship with a woman. And so at the end of the appointment, I realized, you know, basically what this guy is suffering from is loneliness.
Mm.
You know, he's been single for 5 years. He's, you know, it's probably fueling a lot of his anxiety, because when he comes to see me, I'm listening to him, and it's like he's telling me all the stories and all about his life, and it's if he had a partner, he wouldn't have that much, you know, so much need to to share everything with me because he would be less pressured, you know, speechless pressured. He, you know, it's sad. I just feel like he would do better if he had, you know, a loving woman in his life, which is what he said he wanted. So at the end of his appointment, I wrote him a prescription for a girlfriend. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote his medicine, like, for a I wrote something for blood pressure that would also help with his anxiety, just a really light dose of a medicine. And then I wrote, so two prescriptions. One was, like, an actual medication, and mm-hmm. then the other one was a prescription for a girlfriend, which I wrote, I think it said something like, John needs a wonderful woman in his life. I highly recommend him. And then I signed it, you know, it was really cute. And so anyway, he keeps it in his wallet, and he's always ready in case he meets a woman that he can put this prescription out that his doctor says he's a really good guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which, that'd be kind of cool to pull out in a bar. Not everyone has one of those. And so, but he went to the pharmacy. This is super funny, to turn in his medication.
Yeah.
And the pharmacist at Walmart was, of course, being totally comprehensive, reviewing all the side effects for the medication and, you know, fatigue, headache, you know, 1% of people could have this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, your erections might not last as long. And this guy, he's so sweet, you know, and he's like, well, that won't really work with my other prescription. And the pharmacist is like, well, let me see your other prescription. And he gives him his girlfriend prescription. And he said, Dr. Weibel, that pharmacist, he turned as red as Santa Claus, and he didn't know what to do. And he finally looked up, and he said, well, if that happens, just skip a few days. Anyway.
That's really funny. And it's great because, you know, he did have high blood pressure. He did have some mild anxiety. But that wasn't really his whole problem.
Like, I feel like if he had a partner, like a loving life partner, he wouldn't have either of those. So it's not like just treating him for high blood pressure and anxiety is going to solve this. That's just a Band-Aid.
Right.
Just like meditating your way out of the wrong medical field, you know, it's not going to solve that you really want to be a primary care doctor, that you're stuck as an ophthalmologist. You know, mindfulness meditation isn't going to cure that, you know.
Right. It reminds me a lot of when someone's dealing with depression or anxiety and they get and they do start taking medication. You know, the best way to deal with that is to take medication and go to therapy.
Yeah, build the skills that you need so that you can get off the medication.
Exactly.
You know, find out who you are. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So
there's so much more that we could be doing during office visits that's really healing for both parties, the doctor and the patient. You know, if you do a medical appointment the right way, the patient should leave feeling overjoyed, and the doctor should feel more energy after the appointment than they had when they started.
Because,
you know, it should be like an energetic rush.
Yeah, because they do.
That's how you know that you're doing the right thing.
Right, exactly.
Or maybe surgeons feel that way if they have a really interesting case. Even though it took like 5 hours, they were successful at the end. You know, the patient survived, and they probably have a rush of energy.
Right.
I would think.
Yeah, because
I'm not a surgeon, but, you know, that's the same way I feel with primary care when I have a really great session with the patient.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that every patient would say that that's what they want, and I think every doctor would say that's what they want also.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody wanted to learn more about Ideal Medical Care or get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to learn?
Just contact me through idealmedicalcare.org, or I really recommend just checking out the book Pet Goats and Pap Smears. I think it's petgoatsandpapsmears.com, which I wrote specifically for medical students who need to see a light at the end of the tunnel and realize that their dreams are practical and possible. And if you want to get a dose of inspiration, which I think is lacking in medical training, not enough inspiration, then those are just my best 101 patient stories from 20 years of medical practice. It's kind of like chicken soup for the doctor and medical student's soul, which there's not enough books in that genre.
Well, then you'll just have to keep writing them.
Yeah, I know.
And then you're also on Facebook, right? And
yeah. I mean, I get in touch. whoever wants to get in touch with me, I return all their phone calls and emails and Facebook messages, whatever. Yeah, I'm totally available and accessible. And that's so funny. It blows some doctors away. They'll contact me off the, contact page on my website, and sometimes I get back with them within 5 minutes, and they're like, wow, that was quick. But really, if we're on call for our patients and they call us for, after hours, we get back with them right away. It's kind of weird that we don't get back with each other right away, because I think we need a more nurturing environment where medical students really nurture one another rather than compete with mm-hmm. each other. And physicians, again, nurture one another. That's kind of the missing element here.
And the element
it's like that... It kind of feels like every man for himself, right? And then we're just waiting to see what the government's going to do next so that we know how we're going to be led down a path that makes maybe no sense, right? And so, yeah, that's the beauty of the town hall meeting is, let's take our profession back. Why should primary care die an ugly death when it's a beautiful profession, 99% of people can get all their care from, a neighborhood doctor.
And I think that they want
to. Why should that stop? What?
I think that people want to. I don't think people want to go to the hospital for every little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it's my understanding of what people are looking for from medicine and what doctors are looking for from being doctors is nurturing and caring for other people. And if that's not part of what's going on, then there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you so, so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
There she is, Dr. Pamela Weibel, the pioneer of ideal medical care. I hadn't ever really thought about how doctors' mental and emotional health really affects their patients' health. And it seems like this is something we should be paying a lot more attention to. So that's your action item for this week, is to look into ideal medical care. See if there are any ideal clinics in your area. There's a map on her website that you can type in, I think, your address or your zip code or something, and take a look. See what's around you. And if there aren't any clinics, get in touch with Pamela and find out what you can do to get that process started in your community. She is super accessible. She may be one of the fastest email responders that I have dealt with in a long time. And she really prides herself on being super accessible to anybody. So if you want to get in touch with her and learn more about what she's doing, that will be really easy for you to do. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter at Tegan Keating, TEAGANKEATING. The podcast is at Action Phase Pod. Our website is actionphasepodcast.com, and my website is TeganK.com. And you can always email me at actionphasepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much. Have a great week.